SCP-8918. Death was written large everywhere. War is hell, and while that's true for all wars, there have been some that are unquestionably more hellish than others. World War I definitely doesn't get the same amount of attention as the Second, but one reason for that is due to the overall story of the war. While World War II is often painted as a relatively clear-cut case of good versus evil, World War I is far murkier, largely revolving around politics and territory disputes rather than the defeat of an undesirable ideology. The aftermath of World War II had wide-reaching consequences on a global scale, while little changed after the end of the First World War. SCP-8918 is a somewhat unique article, focused around World War I from the perspective of someone who fought in it, and it certainly doesn't depict it as a noble pursuit. Let's take a look. SCP-8918 is the collective designation for the Fab 5, a unit of humanoid anomalies active in the 78th Battalion Canadian Expeditionary Force in the early 20th century. While they were initially a disparate and unrelated set of vigilantes across the country, the entry of Canada into World War I caused them all to volunteer for military service. As their unique abilities were identified, they were quickly grouped together into the Fab 5, a primarily ceremonial unit intended for morale-raising purposes. They were initially deployed to Europe in the spring of 1915 as part of the first wave of troops from the Canadian Expeditionary Force, an all-volunteer division, and they first saw combat at the Second Battle of Ypres in western Belgium. Delays in deployment caused them to miss the First Battle of Ypres the preceding autumn, in which French, British, and Belgian forces had clashed against the German army, with casualties of upwards of 100,000 men. While they were initially intended for a ceremonial role away from the front lines, the group increasingly took part in active combat duties over the rest of the war, with them not permanently returning to Canada until the late winter of 1918 following the Treaty of Versailles. One of them never returned at all, however, having been killed in the Battle of Vimy Ridge in April 1917. They were not mobilized as part of the Canadian Army's preparations for World War II, and while the Foundation made attempts to contain them, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, OSAT, intervened, claiming custody due to their status as veterans of the Canadian Army. Evidence was manufactured to indicate that they had been wholly wiped out in a battle towards the end of the war, allowing them to live relatively free, private lives. Without proof, all of the witness testimonies of the Fab 5's abilities were largely dismissed as over-embellished war stories, but they remained popular in the eye of the Canadian public as a symbol of national pride, owing largely to Fab 5, Canada's Crusaders, a regionally successful series of fiction comic books published throughout the 1960s by National Periodical Publications, now known as DC Comics. It's largely accepted by the Canadian public that the stories of the group's anomalous abilities are a result of the popularity of the comics, rather than vice versa. Although they possess anomalous longevity, they are not immortal, with one of them dying from complications arising from Parkinson's in 2013, at the age of 146, another succumbing to small cell lung cancer in 2019 at the age of 151, and another contracting COVID-19 in early 2020 and dying at the age of 139. As of this writing, SCP-8918-A, whose real name is Lewis McCandell, is the only living member of the unit. Since the group's history was never recorded by mundane World War historians, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police agreed to permit one researcher from the Foundation's History Division to interview McCandell to compile a record of the unit's activities and history before the death of its last member. McCandell's abilities, as described in the comic Fab 5 No. 1, reads, "Caught in a thresher and bleeding to death, he was saved by the ghost of King Arthur. brought back to life, armed with the armor of Lancelot, the strength of Galahad, and the bewitched shield Prydwen, he is sworn to protect the frozen north, the Canadian Shield. McCandle is interviewed by Dr. Harold Blank, who initially calls him Mr. McCandle, before being corrected by a fellow soldier, Bennett, to call him Major McCandle. He begins to say that he's from the Foundation History Division, but McCandle cuts him off, saying that he knows who he is, and he knows he's not from the Mounties, with that hair. Bennett explains that McCandle was briefed beforehand, and Blank may not make any inquiries regarding or subject to classified information or operations. The interview is at McCandle's leisure, and he may end it at any time, with visiting hours ending at 1900 on the dot. Blank hopes that Bennett will leave and not hover over his shoulder, but there's no such luck. So he begins the interview by asking McCandle if he was active in the Canadian Expeditionary Force from 1914 to 1918 as part of the 78th Battalion C Company, and if he fought across the Western Front with members of Squadron B, known as the Fab Five, of which he was the leader. He says yes, as much a leader as was present, and then Blank asks if he was recalled back to Canada after the Treaty of Versailles, not being mobilized for World War II. McCandle answers in the affirmative, and after a moment of silence, Blank claps his hands and rises to his feet, stating that that's that. Bennett asks him what he's talking about, to which Blank says that they asked him to compile a history, and so he did. He thanks McCandle for his service, but they were just five guys out of a few million. Bennett remarks that they were the only anomalous unit in the Canadian Army, and he thinks that Blank can do a little better than an Encyclopedia Britannia summary. McCandle then states that he lied, and he wasn't the leader. He was the squadron's commanding officer, but Drew was the leader, really. Of the five of them, he was the only one who'd seen any real action before. He was in Africa with the Boers. Blank exchanges a look with Bennett before taking his seat again and opening his notepad, asking if he means 8918-B, Andrew Leem, known as Voyager. McCandle says yes, and that he always told them that he had a grandfather at Waterloo under Nelson, though he of course has no idea how much truth there is to that. The rest of them were in a mood, though, so they listened to his stories of fighting the Boers at Spion Kop, felling 100 colonials with one volley of fire. A rifle regiment in full formation, gleaming guns and bright peacoats. They were all in a mood because the Department of the Militia had bungled the planning, and they were to miss the first big push, the first Battle of Ypres. They had been hearing that this would all be said and done by Christmas, so the five of them were of the mind that missing the battle was missing the whole war. It wasn't the case, of course, but they were kids, really. Drew was the oldest and tided them over by telling them how they'd get their chance for glory. Between the five of them, they rationalized, they could take out a rifle company easily. The Germans would see the five children they were facing and tuck their tails between their legs all the way back to Berlin. They'd get medals, girls, and be back home in time for supper. Blank asks how well they all knew each other before the war, to which he says not at all. He'd heard tell of them, and he imagines the others heard much the same about him, but he was just a local, helping out where he could. He halted bank stick-ups and stopped out-of-control locomotives, becoming known as the Calgary Cavalier. He'd heard there were others like him, but he never really cared to look. Then they started getting telegrams about the brouhaha in Europe, and he volunteered to have something real to fight for. He was walking by a paper stand when he saw the headline, "Kaiser Declares War," and he went straight to the recruitment office. The line wrapped around the building, and the sergeant told him to go to the back until he lifted the building straight off the ground. That got their attention. Blank mentions that King Arthur would be impressed, referring to King Arthur's ghost who rescued him from the brink of death, giving him his armor and sword and power, and tasking him to be the protector of all Canada. McCandle just laughs wheezily and says that that was the line they told him to parrot, but there's no King Arthur's ghost. He was tilling his father's wheat field when he fell over a box half sticking out of the ground, a coffin. He pried it open and there was a skeleton in full plate inside, hands wrapped around a shield painted with the Virgin Mary. His fingers touched her face and he's been like this since. Blank admits that he always wondered why King Arthur would appear in rural Canada. McCandle says that it was a shit story and the others had just as shit ones, but they got the job done, to improve morale. Not that they were much needed at the start. Camp was more like a harvest festival than a military way station, with spirits running high. They had no idea what was going on at Marne, at Ypres, so they drank and laughed, with their training rudimentary and decades out of date. They were still learning to march in rifle formation. The other men looked at them like they were going to plant their feet up the Kaiser's rump personally, and he thinks that they thought they would all the way to Ypres. The article then mentions 8918-B, Andrew Leem, known as Voyager, with his abilities described as Voyager keeps his silent watch over Quebec from the skies in La Chaise Galerie, his loyal canoe. Where he sees danger, unlawfulness, and abuse, he descends to dispense justice from his axe. McCandle says that the canoe flew all right. It flew just like Blank. Blank replies that he can't fly, to which McCandle quips that nothing gets by him. The canoe flew perfectly fine at home, but Europe was a different matter entirely. Maybe the air was unfamiliar, maybe she didn't want to be there, which makes her smarter than any of them. In any case, she bucked and kicked and Drew only barely kept her under control while the rest of them held on for dear life over Belgium. They were dispatched as scouts, with Smith Dorian figuring having them sail through the skies and see exactly where the Germans were marshalling would be a perfect boost for morale, with no real danger. The Germans were pushing, with Marne having ruined their plans for a quick war. Ypres sat at the mouth of the Yser, and the Flemish coast provided a perfect staging ground. Blank cuts him off by making a noise, and says that with as little offense as possible, can they get to the important bits? He then hastily remarks that that came out wrong, but says that he's not a military historian, and that's not what he does. He doesn't care about it. He doesn't care about long lists of dates and battles and maps of maneuvers and pushes and which general was at which offensive. Bennett asks if that makes it a less important field, because it bores him. But Blank says that it's a less important field because military historians write their dissertations with one hand. It's all sitting around and number crunching on death and butchery and murder without making any kind of salient point on how it happened or why it was bad. McCandle coughs and tells him to quit his whining and he'll tell him a story. He asks Blank if he knows where his shield is, to which Blank answers, the Museum of History in Quebec, and he saw it there when he was a kid. McCandle asks if he noticed that his armor wasn't with it, and Blank is intrigued, but McCandle falls into a wet coughing fit for several seconds before recovering. He explains that they landed in Marseille, marching towards Belgium on the dirt roads. They were in full uniform, with freshly starched coats and gleaming spats and shined boots. Hinterlander and him were allowed to be out of uniform, of course, with them making a ridiculous image, him in his armor and Hinterlander in his furs talking to the officers' mounts. Spirits were barely dimmed by the never-ending train of white-covered wagons passing them on the other side of the road, heading back the way they came. They made camp a few miles from the front and were told by the general to take Drew's canoe and scout out the formations. So the five of them piled into this creaky canoe and began paddling, taking to the sky. He pauses for a moment before remarking that France and Belgium are beautiful from the sky, all rolling green hills and pastures. He remembers that, even in the dark. The moon overhead, them leaning over the sides and trying to make out anything from the shadows. He pauses again before continuing, saying that Drew was so busy trying to contain the canoe's weaving that he didn't consider what she might be weaving from. All of a sudden they were topsy-turvy and holding on for dear life became literal. Everything was spinning around so fast that he vomited inside of his helm. He could smell smoke, and they were falling in a graceless dive, crashing back down to earth. He imagines he fainted at some point, or suffocated on his own sick. It was a stray mortar, and to this day he has no idea if the Germans were actually aiming at them or not. It was pure confusion, and he awoke to Drew screaming in his ear and dull thumping. He barks out a laugh and says that he pushed Drew away, telling him he didn't want to march. He had no idea where he was, and Drew yanked his helm off. All of a sudden, the dull thumping was a sharp booming, and there was smoke and something coppery in his nose. He was face down in the mud, and he tried to get up as Drew screamed something he couldn't hear over the steady booming. When he didn't listen to whatever he said, he pulled his leg out from underneath him and sent him crashing to the dirt again. He was going to sock Drew in the face until he heard the machine gun fire cut through the air where he'd been a moment ago. His greaves became warm, and he realized that he'd soiled himself. They had crashed in no man's land, and Drew crawled on his belly towards him and touched his head to show him the blood. He screamed to follow him, and he started crawling after him blindly. For the better part of an hour, all he could see were the soles of his boots, wiggling side to side as they plastered themselves as close to the mud as possible, and crawled. They'd change heading from time to time, and he wouldn't understand why until he came to the corpse and scooted around it. He couldn't tell which side most of them were on. He had been hit quite badly in the head, although he didn't realize it at the time. He didn't understand much of anything going on, and it was all a bit hazy. He just kept his mind on Drew's stories about standing in rifle formation, kneeling, and firing. At some point he realized that he stopped moving, as some part of his armor was caught in those loops of barbed wire that laid across the field. He tried to pull himself free, to no avail, and he couldn't extricate it without rising, and couldn't rise without being turned into ribbons by the Germans' guns. He thinks some part of his mind realized then that he might die there, far from home, that he'd never taste his mother's pot roast again, or feel the calluses on his father's hands again when he embraced him, or hear the donkey's brain when the snow began to thaw and drip through the patchy straw roof of their stables. It had been winter when they'd left Halifax, and all of them would be seeing the spring thaw now, with him to bleed to death in a mud field in Belgium. He began to weep quite earnestly then, until eventually one of the group noticed that he was not with them. Drew came back, and he was not gentle, as there was really no time to be gentle. He roughly grabbed his collar and pulled him forward, with enough force to snap the piece of armor off of his body, before dragging him for a dozen meters, until something in him righted itself and his arms began to move again, pulling him forward. They crawled like that until he reached Hinterlander, and they all began to move as one body again, with Drew's fingers wrapped around his collar, and Hinterlander's hand grasping Nelson until they reached the lights of the British line and fell over the top into the trench. He must have made a fine sight, a knight, sobbing, covered in mud and his own piss, half his greaves missing. The group was all sobbing, he noticed. And he remarks again that they were just boys, really. As for 8918-C, his real name is listed as unknown, and his abilities read, abandoned in the wilderness just after birth, raised by wolves, taught to fight by bears. He speaks no tongue of man. He has wandered south to enact the brutal justice of Mother Nature. He is the Hinterlander. Blank asks McCandle if he really never spoke, to which he says that He spent 6 years alongside the man, and he only ever heard him speak once. When Blank asks what he said, however, he just says that it's not important. Blank objects, saying that he's the Hinterlander. He doesn't speak. That's his whole deal. So of course it's important. McCandle replies that that was never truly accurate, as he spoke quite a lot, just not to other people. He admits, though, that he has no idea how much of that was the Hinterlander talking to animals as opposed to him listening, as he was a fine listener. In any case, it came in awfully handy too many times to count, and he begins to laugh before being interrupted by a coughing fit. He says that once, they cut off an Austrian artillery brigade at Verdun from reinforcements, and a squirrel came up to the Hinterlander. He was 7 feet tall, all muscle, draped in skinned animals, with even the other soldiers being afraid of him. But this little brown squirrel wandered up to him, asking for a nut. He reached into one of those hide pouches, silent as can be, pulled out a walnut, and handed it to the creature. In return, it told them exactly where an Austrian relief force was moving through the forest with much-needed artillery shells. That was a good, clean victory. Blank circles back to the time Hinterlander spoke to McCandle in English, saying that it feels like the kind of thing that should go in history. McCandle thinks for a moment before stating that it was in late 1916, at the Somme, causing both Blank and Bennett to look up. Blank remarks that he thought they were a morale unit, but McCandle explains that that fantasy ended at Ypres. They spent a week huddling in the trenches, knee-deep in mud and rain and sleet, shoulder to shoulder with the British and the French, ducking at the sound of German cannon fire, manning the machine gun when the gunner collapsed from exhaustion. He abandoned parts of his armor, as it turns out that armor, enchanted to shatter the enemy's blade, is of little use when you never even see your foe, and he took to wearing a hodgepodge of plate and uniform, although he kept his shield. The command clung to them being a morale unit, though, sending them on victory parades in captured towns, on the rare occasion there remained anything to parade through. Ypres taught them a valuable lesson, though, that the command is worse than useless. They will blindly send you into artillery fire, or an ambush, or some other death trap. They'll throw you to the dogs 1,000 times over to claw a square inch of ground. The only ones you can rely on are the men next to you in the trench. The group wasn't going to abandon them, so when the battalion was ordered to march to the Somme for the third offensive, they followed. He pauses and says that if Ypres was death, then the Somme was hell. In Ypres, at least, you knew where the enemy was. You knew to huddle inside the trench, behind the wire, and you knew when the cannon fire began to press yourself to the ground and pray. The cannon fire never really began at the Somme, because it never really ended. There was no moment in which you could not feel your bones shaking, whether from their own guns or the Germans returning fire. For 2 months they stayed there, learning to live around, live with these monstrous pieces of artillery. They stood, they fought, they jammed, but never broke. And they survived, so to survive, he became like them. Hiding in the trench, although to call it a trench would be a gross understatement. Ypres had a trench, with wood slat fortifications and structure, kerosene lamps and signal wires. This was a hole in the ground filled with men. The wooden posts had long since rotted away in the watery standstill that had accumulated, and the walls were more packed dirt than anything. Every time it rained, a little more would give away, joining the ankle-deep muddy water. His leg twitches, and he says that he was glad he kept his sabatons, as too many others weren't so lucky. Kicking horse caught a nasty bout of trench foot, with the skin on the soles of his feet growing white and beginning to slough off. He couldn't run until he recovered, which meant he was more or less useless. When they first joined the forces, it was in the middle of a minor German push. Everyone was kneeling, packed like sardines, grunting and groaning under the deafening guns. A French corporal next to him was sucking down some moldy crumbs of bread as though it were a delicacy. He told him he should watch out for rats, but the man just smiled and said something in French. He didn't speak French, so he thought he was thanking him until Drew passed by and related to him. The man had said that even the rats do not come down here, which McCandle thinks sums up the conditions nicely. There were animals, though, dogs and cockroaches, and the officers had to have their horses, of course, safely behind the line and out of danger. These were officers who had been raised on stories of their fathers in Crimea and felt that an officer without his horse was no officer at all. The hinterlander spent days in the stables, caring for them, and whether all that nonsense about being raised in the wild was true or not, he had a remarkable way with horses. He would sit, brush them, they would talk, and he would listen. Then he would come back, motion for a map, and mark down the path of a German patrol. Blank asks how would a horse know that, to which he suspects that the horses had little regard for the war and were more than happy to chat with their German brethren. The hinterlander never said, but he loved those horses, easily more than their officers did, and they were probably smarter than them. McCandle had assumed their group's role would be to squat in the mud and wait for an opening, maybe relying on the tanks the British commanders kept talking about with the tone one typically reserves for Christ. But they were there one night, with shells streaking across the sky, when suddenly there was a great commotion, and all the British and Canadians were stirring, waking themselves up, checking their Enfields. He asked one what was going on, and he shouted that they were going over. He then asked in confusion where they were going over, and the man looked at him like he was an invalid, but said, over the top. He couldn't believe it, as the guns were still firing, and as long as the Germans were firing, they were firing back. They were being sent out with their backs to their own machine guns. The only thing that brought him a faint shred of hope was that the cavalry was coming with. Surely they would only produce the cavalry if they felt they had a chance of success. So they stood there, waiting, as the horse thumped its legs and allowed Lieutenant Crowley on, and Crowley shouted a number of words none of them heard, and then they waited for several minutes more until the German guns fell silent for a moment. Then his body was moving as mechanically as the guns, tugging himself over after the rush of mounted cavalry, black and white and brown steeds hurtling into the vast empty space of no man's land. In a shrieking, screaming rush, they followed. To be honest, he remembers very little. He knows that he shot his Enfield and might have hit someone. There was a lot of shouting, and he remembers smelling burning oil and hearing metal grinding against metal as they charged. He lifted his head and drifted towards the smoke, bullets whisking all around him, with shouting in German, French, and English. A lumbering, ugly box had keeled itself into a pit, one of those famously indestructible tanks. Bennett chimes in to say that that was the first battle they were used in, to which McCandle replies that you could tell. It was bleeding oil and listing forward dangerously. He got a hand underneath its treads and lifted it up, setting it right, and it began inching forward again. It slowly crept forward, slow enough that he knew the German it had run over was dead long before he caught a look of his face. He had been crushed by the sheer weight of the thing landing on him in his trench, bones jutting through skin, and a uniform almost wholly stained red. He was about McCandle's age, and his eyes were bulging out of his skull. Then a horse's hoof caved his skull in, with the cavalryman hardly even slowing down. McCandle's head turned to look at that instead, and as he watched, their opening ended. The Germans had, it seems, cleared their jammed guns. Voyager shouted for them to fall back, but a cavalry charge, once begun, cannot be stopped. One by one, like dominoes, the horses began to fall by the half dozen as the Maxim guns tore them up, screaming as they lurched and crashed to their sides, breaking ribs or legs on the way down, or falling into barbed wire or such. He crawled across the field with the others, and they did their best to pull away the men who had fallen. They came upon a cavalryman who was pinned by his thrashing steed, screaming in pain. Unthinkingly, McCandle pulled him towards him, with his lower half remaining trapped by the horse and his innards spilling out across the mud. By then, he was rather accustomed to the sight of blood, and like a machine, he moved on, running directly into Hinterlander, who was frozen in place, eyes agape. The man who could never be stopped, or flummoxed, or confused, standing stock still. He imagines that he was hearing the death cries of 100 horses, but he dragged him back to the trench with him. He just stared at the wall for quite some time, but spoke years later when they returned to the site of the battle after Versailles. It was deathly still, bereft of all life. The bodies had been cleared, but the trenches had yet to be filled in. The generals wanted photographs of them at the site of their victory, for the newspapers at home. They looked out across the battlefield, and nothing had changed. They could have been standing there right then, or 5 years prior, or 50. It would still be France. The border had been reset to the Rhine as it had been for hundreds of years. No territory exchanged hands, and no city was saved or razed. Hinterlander turned to him, and asked so softly that he thought he had imagined it. Why? After a pause, Blank asks what he told him, to which McCandle says that he told him the truth, that he didn't know. 8918-D's real name was Nathaniel Nelson, with his abilities being caught in a blizzard. He was saved from certain death by the North herself. Chosen to be her avatar, ice water runs through his veins. His slightest touch can freeze a grown man. Snowstorms are his to command. He is the snowman. Blank asks if fire was really his weakness, or if it was just BS, with McCandle replying that he tended to avoid open flames, but he never mentioned if they hurt. Blank remarks that he must have come in handy on the battlefield, but McCandle says less so than you might imagine. He doesn't know if that tripe about being the avatar of the North was hogwash or not, but his abilities were certainly more limited when they were over there. He wasn't making any snowstorms out of thin air, but when it did snow or sleet, and it frequently did, he could be counted on to make sure the brunt of it hit the German lines instead of theirs. It was still quite unbearable, though. Not the cold, but the wet. The cold bothered you, made you huddle up into your overcoat, but the wet soaked you and chilled you to the bone. The wet made your fingers wrinkle up like a prune and shake so hard you prayed no one came over because you doubted you'd be able to pull a trigger. Your feet would soak it up and the skin would start to rot off. He caught his first bout of trench foot at Passchendaele, calling it a miserable, disastrous shitshow. Blank remarks that that hardly seems particular to Passchendaele, so McCandle says it was the most miserable and disastrous shitshow out of a war filled with them. He was doing the same thing as anyone else, trying to survive. Back to Ypres, to where he'd first seen what this was really all like, with this being the third attempt to take control of the region. Just throwing men against it like dolls until the walls fell. No one wanted another campaign in Flanders. It was a fool's errand, and so those in command were, of course, fools. They had shite orders to match out shite equipment, jamming rifles, wet ammunition, cardboard souls from people with cardboard souls. To make the rest of them fools as well, it began to rain and rain and rain. It went from a delay to a problem to the slow realization that the command was going to make them strike against a well-defended village in the pouring, freezing rain. Nate turned out to have a knack for tactics, moving men, ambushes, all that. Some junior officers would defer to him in the field, but never the senior officers. They didn't like enlisted men, as they hadn't been to war college, hadn't commanded an artillery brigade, or mowed down scores of Hindus wielding clubs in India. They were animals to be commanded, and when a battle was a victory, it was owed to the tactical brilliance of the commander. When a battle was a defeat, it was because the enlisted men were cowards and buffoons. With the other soldiers looking up to Nate as a sort of spokesman, he tried to tell them in the general's tent that attacking in the rain was a disaster. McCandle remembers when Nate came back to the trenches, sheets of rain crashing down, and told them straightforwardly that there would be no change. They would attack regardless of the weather. Tensions were high, as they heard that some of the French had mutinied, and such patriotic sentiments were zipping about the trenches like wildfire. Nevertheless, 2 days later, the attack commenced. Midway into the advance, they were being pummeled by German artillery so badly that Haig canceled the attack. That first attack was a failure, and so began 2 months of pointless, nipping exchanges with the Germans until they were ordered with the rest of the Canadian divisions to Ypres to relieve the Australians. He found himself in the same damnable trench he'd crawled into, sobbing like a baby, and it felt like a different life. It finally gave them their crack at Passchendaele, though, and it took them another month, but they eventually pushed the Germans out. He says that it's a nothing village, insignificant except for the hill it sits on, and he remembers himself and Nate walking into this falling apart village. Shops and houses all reduced to rubble, the church steeples sagging dangerously, and more potholes than cobblestone. They just looked around for some time as the rest of the divisions began to filter in, set up tents, and occupy the village, clearing out any last pockets of resistance. An officer rode in on his horse and launched into a spiel about how many of them had died, but their sacrifices were now avenged. They listened, but they just couldn't believe it, really, that this village could possibly be worth the 500,000 dead men it took to claim it. Blank asks him if he talked to Nelson much after coming back, but McCandle says no, outside of keeping some correspondence. When asked why not, he says that Nelson came home and found out his two younger brothers had joined up while he was gone. They'd gone and gotten themselves killed at Verdun, and he supposes that he never really knew what to say to that. Nelson spent more and more time up north, and McCandle saw him less and less down here, and then eventually, he didn't see him at all. The last of the team, SCP-8918-E, whose real name was Donovan Lansky, had abilities which read, "After being flung off a bucking bronco, he awoke with his heart beating 100 times a second and all the speed of a wild Mustang. The man who takes breakfast in Vancouver and lunch in Quebec, kicking horse." Blank asks McCandle if he made up for his age and wit, as the books always showed, and he replies that yes, he couldn't have been older than 15, but he was smart. Blank then asks if he was Jewish, which he was, and notes that he was the only one not to return from the war, asking what happened. McCandle replies that he was always racing around, making him a fine scout. They were at Vimy Ridge, with them being split up across the divisions. McCandle was to support the assault on Thelis, and Lansky was to rush ahead, scouting out how dug in the Germans were, so they would know whether the heavy artillery on the hills should focus on supporting their advance or bombarding the village. McCandle was in with the 3rd Division, and says that it was chaos, with no idea what was happening. He told Lansky what to do, to go in, take a quick look-see, and come back immediately, with no being a hero. Blank guesses that he didn't listen, but McCandle says that he listened perfectly. He just didn't expect that the Germans would already be retreating from Thelis and fortifying themselves higher up the ridge. He ran in, straight into a cloud of poison gas. He showed up back to their position in the flash of an eye, coughing and wheezing and stumbling. The gas shreds your lungs, and he breathed so much that it had just been going around and around in his chest. He was spitting up blood while he was trying to tell them about the gas, and then he died. Blank offers his condolences before saying that he doesn't think it was McCandle's fault. McCandle asks why the hell would it be his fault, as he's not the Hun that ordered poison gas be pumped into a village. After a brief silence, McCandle says that he's asked him a lot of questions today, and asks if he gets one. He asks Blank if he's a cat, to which he says he isn't, last time he checked. So McCandle tells him to cough up that hairball he's been letting marinate in his throat all day. He's been pretending he doesn't give a damn about the stories, but he grew up on those books. And Blank admits that he had a couple dozen of them. McCandle breaks into a coughing fit before saying that they were the worst decision he ever made. They were nonsense stories, filling young people's heads with ideas about how they heroically pushed back the Huns. Blank replies that they were stories about heroes, and they were good for him, giving him something to look up to. McCandle says that there was nothing heroic about anything that happened over there. And Blank says that there was definitely nothing heroic after. McCandle then remarks that there it is, and he ought to have known it that it'd be about that. How when they asked them, 20 years later, to go back to Europe and do it all over again, they were the only ones smart enough to say no. Blank says that he gets it. World War I was a shit show, with needless, pointless bloodshed, and it didn't need to happen. But he can't seriously think that it was the same the second time around. McCandle just replies that it's always the same. To which Blank says that yes, war is hell. It's awful and horrible and evil. But doesn't he think some things are worth fighting for? McCandle just says that it's their war, and we should let them deal with it instead of sending our sons to die again. Blank argues that they were Nazis. But McCandle just says that they were Europeans fighting Europeans again, dragging them into their squabbles. Blank grows more vocal, yelling that he cannot be dumb enough to think that it would never come home. Even if it never did, it was genocide, and plenty of other people who served saw that and volunteered. McCandle asks what concern it is of his, what a lunatic dictator in Germany or Italy or wherever else wants to do to his people, and Blank begins sputtering. He yells that he was alive then. He must have seen the papers, the pictures, of Auschwitz and Dachau and Buchenwald, asking how the hell he can say that that wasn't their problem. McCandle asks why should they bleed for every injustice, and Blank yells back that that's what heroes are supposed to do. There's a brief silence before Blank asks him if he knows how many kids read those books, growing up hearing about how he saved a platoon in Passchendaele or rescued an entire village of French children at Verdun and wanted to be like him. And now he turns around and lets him know that you actually shouldn't intervene in the most monstrous injustice in human history, that he won't rise above the petty politics and do the right thing. He asks, what the hell kind of message does that send? And there's more silence as McCandle's heart monitor beeps steadily. Eventually, he quietly says that they weren't heroes. They were kids playing costume that thought helping people was saving a burning building or taking a cat down from a tree. And they took them and fed them into the meat grinder. Blank agrees that they did, and he's sorry that happened, but it doesn't make the rest of it okay. McCandle is silent for several moments before finally looking up, his eyes hard, and he says that that's awfully easy to say from that chair. Had Blank been where he's been, seen what he's seen, he'd do anything to stop even one other kid from having to do any of that. Blank just replies that he guesses he's glad that he didn't turn out like him when he grew up. Blank submitted his notes from the interview 4 days later, with a final historical record of 89-18 still being drafted. Following the interview, the RCMP OSAT indicated willingness to allow additional interviews, but these were declined, as neither Blank nor McCandle expressed interest in meeting with the other again. It's certainly an article that relies very little on being in the SCP universe, and much of it doesn't even revolve around the fact that the Fab Five were anomalous. That being said, it definitely paints an accurate and somber picture of World War I and the sheer pointlessness of it all. The interactions between Blank and McCandle are notable, as Blank grew up on heroic comic book characters and didn't experience these things for himself, so he can't fathom how his hero could be, in his mind, so unheroic. McCandle, on the other hand, experienced the horrors of war and the active callousness of command, and had no interest in repeating the experience, especially with it being so far from his home. While perhaps it's true that all it takes for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing, doing something about it is easier said than done, and it's hard to blame McCandle and the others for not wanting to take another step into hell.